Okay, so part two is a conversation about Michael Terosian's interviewing technique. And in one of the Ed Bertinsky chapter, you, Michael, provide the reader with a valuable list of
Guidelines.
guidelines describing your methodology. As mentioned earlier, we talked about the fact that you consider the interview to be the foundation of research, the ultimate primary source document, and a unique literary form in its own right. I'll just read out the first item in the guideline. And again, this idea here of the importance of asserting the voice of the artist. I educate myself to the fullest extent about the artist's life and work. So, how do you go about doing that?
Well, some artists, there's a considerable amount of literature on them. Certainly, Siskin was a good subject in terms of research because there were a number of books on him, and I was able to acquire and read all of those. So that's a good starting point. But typically, now, of course, with the advent of the internet, you can source a lot more stuff and find interviews that have previously been done, maybe in a journal at a university or something like that. Or you might find essays about the artist's work by curators or critics and things like that. So I try to compile absolutely everything.
Because you're doing, sorry, in depth. This is a significant undertaking of, in many cases, several days at least.
Yes. The first step is just to do a lot of research. Of course, this includes familiarizing myself with all of their work, because it's not just about getting biographical information, it's also having a working knowledge of all of their imagery, so I can talk about it intelligently with them. That can be a very consuming part of the research aspect of doing a book. But, I probably already had a chunk of it done simply because I already admired their work and had looked at it before. The book was the impetus to really go into depth.
I like what you say here too. You say, I don't want confirmation of what I know.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the kiss of death to a lot of interviewers. They just gravitate to the most familiar aspects of the artist's life that they know about, and they get reiteration of the same old story.
Yeah. I cringe when I hear that, incidentally. I mean, it's like, oh, please don't give me this because I know it's nothing new.
But also, I don't want agreement with my opinion. My opinions are not the issue in an interview. The story of the artist, the perspective of the artist is what's important. So let's say there's a certain aspect of their work that does not engage me as much as another part. I don't want to just pass over that and ignore it. I want to get into that so I can try to really understand what I am missing. It's as I was saying before, when I first came to photography, I assumed that if a photograph was in a gallery or was in a book, it must have significance. And if I didn't see that right away, it was my job to come to an understanding, to make that kind of effort. So when I look at the work of an artist that I'm going to do a book on, if there's something that I don't care for that, doesn't mean that much to me, I feel it's my obligation to examine that. Otherwise, you're always retreating to your safe space. You're always looking at the same thing. You're not challenging your mind. Sometimes you have to look at works that on first blush don't engage you that much, and it's incredibly rewarding
Well, it's learning, isn't it?
I cannot tell you. One of the repetitive wonderful experiences of my artistic life is going to an exhibition and seeing a body of work with fresh eyes, something that maybe I had seen 25 or 30 years ago that I didn't understand and I just brushed it off. And now I find it totally captivating. And I think to myself, whatever happened in the ensuing decades, that's great, thank God, because now I can embrace this work.
Yeah, it's newly exciting.
It is. It's truly exciting. And it's you know, it's sort of the transit from apathy and ignorance to understanding and maybe a little bit of wisdom. But it's a nice transit. So I'm always looking at things that are unfamiliar to me. I've seen so many exhibitions in my life that I don't like to see exhibitions that are compilations of things that I've seen dozens of times before. I'd rather go outside my comfort zone and look at something that I'm totally unfamiliar with. And that really informs a lot of my choices when it comes to the art I look at.
Yeah, as far as the interviews go, I mean, the difference between your interviews and mine is that people listen to mine. I think, though, that this idea of questioning someone about things that you don't know, that you're curious about, the listener, I hope, is interested in following that path, too. It's like getting the answers to questions that, they thought of or that they didn't think of, but that it is a moving from known to unknown, you know?
Yeah, you have to create a narrative within the interview. You can't just have a bunch of questions and answers. It has to have an inner propulsion. It has to be directed at something, a revelation about their thinking, an experience in their life.
Well, you say about their life, speaking about their life, yeah. You talk about that, don't you? Their life story is a natural propeller.
It's the basic armature that you can string all ideas off of.
Yeah.
If you don't talk about somebody's life experience, if you're just talking about ideas all the time, I think the narrative can sort of stall out. It can become stagnant. But if you have an idea that emerges from the context of an actual anecdote, all of a sudden, it's animated. It brings in their life, their experience, the coloration of where they are, what time, who they were with. I just think it's a technique that works. I think it's not like I invented it. I think this is something that is probably from 100 years of reading, people have gravitated towards this kind of thing. This is one of the things about the book, and I've probably said this innumerable times.
Today or just generally?
Just in my life.
Okay.
But, you know, the most abundant artifact from the Middle Ages are books. Things like clothing barely exist because it would just deteriorate. Things like suits of armor still exist, but a lot of them got melted down to make something else. So a lot of things from the Middle Ages perished, but there are an abundance of books because they were cherished, they were preserved, they were treasured. And we have like 1,000 years of books being perceived as being very special. And I think in terms of evolution, we're at a point where human beings are hardwired to love books. It's actually in their synapses. They revere books as objects. That's why the idea of a book burning is so repugnant to people, because you're talking about an object that you revere.
How does that connect to biography?
Well, what I was going to say was, I think in much the same way that certain things get hardwired into people's brains, the way you tell a story with, you could say, thesis, exploration, conclusion, that kind of thing is hardwired into a person's approach and expectation of a story. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. What you have to do is you have to come up with a novel, interesting way of going through the material so that you have this exploration, you have this revelation.
But you want the person that you're interviewing to be interested too, right? You want to get interesting new stuff from them. And so you're saying that's the technique, that is a technique that helps you to do that too. I'm thinking about the listener, but you're thinking about the person you're interviewing and the reader eventually.
Yeah, I mean, I usually by the time I arrive to do an interview, my brain is steeped in their work. I got lots of questions on my mind. How they're going to tumble out is determined by my experience of the day. I don't adhere to a script. I let things unfold. And as I say, situational awareness is the most important thing. Stay in the moment. Yes. Listen carefully to what your subject is saying and use everything you've researched to inform the next question. Really, it's a matter of however many hours I'm involved in doing an interview. I just stay in the moment. Stay with what they're thinking and try to develop the whole conversation based on that.
Yeah, and in that respect, moving on to number two, you do make lists of questions, but then the list gives you the comfort that you've considered the shape of the conversation. Then you throw the list away. To be interesting, an interview has to be organic. An event of informed spontaneity.
Yeah, I mean, I remember going up to Gordon Parks' apartment on the 10th floor of United Nations Plaza at like 10 o'clock at night. And we'd go into his music room where he had his stereo system and a keyboard. And his assistant, before she checked out for the night, would like make him a sandwich or something.
Right.
And we'd sit there and we'd talk late into the night. Now, can you imagine if you pulled out a sheet of paper and started reading questions, how that would completely fracture the mood? The only way to do it was simply put the tape recorder on the desk. He would eat and we would talk and I would have my questions in my mind. And we just had a conversation and I would use my techniques to keep us on track. So that, you know, we wouldn't end up talking about something in current events that day, you know, about some problem with the subway in New York City all day. Now, I find that if you do something like pull out a piece of paper sometimes, it seems so incongruous to the intimacy of the moment you sort of break the spell. I just found it was, it never really worked for me. I have so many questions in my brain. Having them on a clipboard or something is really unnecessary.
Yeah, I find, again, giving the perspective of someone who interviews for an audience, in our particular case, we're having a conversation. I've got questions and thoughts written down. But when I go back to them, I typically see that, we've covered off almost all of them anyway. In other words, the conversation...
Yeah, it blossoms on its own.
Yeah.
You don't have to... If once you get rolling, what you find is, what I found is, these people have something to say. You know, it's not like they have never thought about their work and they have no life experience. In the case of people like Summer and Siskin, they were in their 80s. They'd been around the block. They had a lot of life experience and they had lots of stories to tell. You know, when I interviewed Dave Heath for the book on Korea, he'd served in the army in Korea. So, of course, that gave us a starting point right there because he had a lot of stories about that. So I'm starting off with individuals who have a lot of life experience.
Okay. And you like to begin by plucking from the uniqueness of that day, that very day, you say.
Mm-hmm.
the inception of our new experience. And then you segue into the work and the chronology of their life. What are you talking about there? You just, like, you just want to make them feel comfortable and at ease?
To sit down and say, in 1956, you had a show at the Sydney Janus Gallery. How did that come about?
Yeah.
What? We're talking about 1956? You just got here. You know, instead I would say, oh, I see that in the dry mounting press, you've got this picture. Is this a new picture? Is this for a book or portfolio? Mm-hmm. And it's like, I'm working on a project. And it's something new that I just thought up. And all of a sudden, you're talking about their activity right now, what's going through their mind. You say, you know, that's interesting that you're working on this, because in 1956, when you had that show at the Sydney Janus Gallery, it related. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. And it doesn't seem like a cold start. It seems like now you've related something that actually has some kind of logic. Now, when it comes to editing for the book, you can cut off that front part.
Yeah. But you want a rapport. I mean, that's a big part of what this is, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I don't think I ever have a circumstance where I just sort of show up, even if I'm doing something like going out to Cushing, Maine, you know, flying from Toronto to New York to Rockland, and then taking the rental car all the way into Cushing. By the time I arrive, there's still enough time to go out for supper with Siskin, spend the evening with him, shoot the breeze. And then by the time we start the interview in the morning, we're all warmed up.
I mean, obviously, you're hoping fervently that he'll agree to this whole thing. So in terms of the approach, like, what do? You say...
When I contact an artist?
Yeah.
I think I must have been incredibly innocent for the most part, because I would just, like, with Siskin, I wrote him a one-page letter, put it inside my latest book, and essentially said, here's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoy this book. I want to do a book like this on you.
That's an appealing appeal.
Yeah.
That's what that is right,
like,
there.
You know, could you give me a call?
Yeah. Okay. You know, I understand. Yeah.
Like, and he sent me a postcard and said, I have a guest room.
Yeah. Yes. But so you're letting your previous work do the introduction and the pitch.
As I say in the book about Gordon Parks, I wanted to phone him up, but a colleague of mine really put me off. He said, you know, the photographers you've done books on are major artists, but Gordon Parks is in a category all by himself. He's a movie director. He's a celebrity.
Yeah.
You'll probably have to go through his agent just to talk to him. And I was so intimidated by this. For 3 months, I couldn't bring myself to phone him. And then one day I said, what's wrong with you? So I phoned him and said, you know, I'm a couple blocks away from your apartment. Can I come over and see you? And he said, okay. And he was very nice.
No, but would he have said that to anyone? No.
I have no idea.
No, but what did you say when you've called him?
I don't know. I just introduced myself over the phone.
And I want to do a book on you?
I think I probably said that. I mean, I was trying to be as forthright as possible and explain my objectives, my intentions. And he was very, very nice. He, you know, he said, yeah, if you want to come up.
Yeah.
And when he came to the door, he was wearing a baseball cap and gym shorts and a T-shirt and a bathrobe. And he said, do you want to see some photographs? I said, yeah, sure. And he said, well, I've taken some slides. The only room dark enough to look at them is the bedroom. So we went in the bedroom. He closed the door. We're sitting on the bed in the dark, and he's showing me his newest pictures. And, like, I've only met him for, like, 30 seconds, and we're talking about photography.
In his bedroom.
Yeah, it was so exciting because he had no pretensions.
Yeah.
It was just like we were just totally engaged in the thing that we both loved.
Yeah.
And so we looked at the pictures. We went out to the living room. We talked for like 3 hours just about stuff. And it was a wonderful way to start this relationship. And every time I was in New York, I'd go up to his apartment and we'd have some more conversations. And just, I did the interview over the course of like almost a year.
You mentioned, you know, both loving the same thing and both being, you know, fascinated and both being practitioners. I mean, that right there is a pretty good foundation for a good conversation, certainly.
Yeah, I mean,
shared love of
we're both from I don't know, the same tribe or something.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, you mentioned this staying in the moment, listening, of course. Maintaining situational awareness. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, just the admonition that don't do what some interviewers do, which is they stick to their script so doggedly that if the subject says something really interesting that's slightly off their script, they don't pursue it. You've got to
Just hanging there, right?
Yeah, you've got to keep up with your subject. And if they go off in some kind of parallel thought for a moment, you have to decide if it's valuable. If it's not, then you have to sort of work them back to where you are. But if it's valuable, you've got to be able to depart from your line of thinking, engage in their line of thinking, and then associate that with your other points that you want to pursue. But you can't just sort of say, well, I've got my script, I've got to stick to it. That's really, I've seen too many bad interviews. You know, these are lessons not only of the positive things I've learned, but the negative things that I've observed.
Well, I was going to say, speaking of observing, I mean, that if it's going out to an audience, it becomes patently obvious that you just missed a big opportunity because they just said something fascinating and you're going to return to something nowhere near as fascinating.
Yeah, that's one of the great advantages of a printed interview. Yeah. I remember when I read the Paris Review interviews, I subsequently read some stories about people like George Plimpton and other Paris Review interviewers. And they would say, well, you know, I just finished this interview with this author and we sent him the interview and he commented on it. So then we followed up with some more questions, spliced that into the original interview based on these embellishments that he had thought of after the fact. And this is how we came up with the final interview. And I thought, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
If you can really articulate something better or expand on an idea, then why not? Why just leave it to this moment in time that you can never recapture? So I thought that they had the best approach. And when you're doing an interview for a book, you do have that opportunity to sort of fine-tune little things and pursue little ideas to their logical conclusion.
Yeah, just again, putting the podcast hat on, and to your point there, your next point is avoid leading questions. And what I would say to that is, yeah, sure, you want them to answer it in their own words. But often what I'll do is I'll answer it to some extent because I know they've already talked about that. I want them to come up with something fresh.
Right. Yeah, but I've also seen a lot of interviews where the question has an implied answer in it.
Yeah, yes, of course.
So the subject is actually backed into a corner. They've got nowhere to go.
Yeah.
And I think that's a real fault. So I try never to do that. I try to keep my questions relatively simple and conversational, as though, you know, we're just batting ideas around.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm trying to be hyper aware all the time. If it was easy, everybody would do it. But, it does take a certain experience and skill to be able to do interviews over and over and over again in different situations.
Yeah. Yeah, and again, for an audience, you want to keep it interesting. And to keep it interesting, you've said that it's like thesis, exploration, some sort of discovery.
Yeah, revelation, conclusion, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, keeping it interesting is
key. You know what Moss Hart said? Moss Hart's explanation of dramatic structure was, get him up a tree, shake a stick at him, get him down again.
That's beautiful. Thank you for that.
It sounds comical. The truth is, what he's saying is, you know, thesis, exploration, revelation.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And my attitude is, when I sit down to write a book, the first thing I think is, I got to get them up the tree really fast.
Yeah.
Then I can spend the whole book shaking the stick at them.
Right.
And then I can find a way to get them down again. That's the first order of business. Get them up the tree.
Right. Number six is you probe for greater detail. And I think that's just so apt. So many answers are generalities, and it's boring as hell.
Yeah. You've got to create a stage set for the mind. People have to be able to see the action within its four dimensions. Every once in a while, I'll see a movie where there's some action scene, and I have no idea where anybody is. Are the cops shooting at themselves? Are they shooting at the bad guys? The director hasn't been able to map it out in any coherent way so you can follow the action. And it's much the same when you're telling a story. If you don't set the stage and place the players within it, then your reader can't follow you at all. So that's part of getting the detail in an interview.
Mm.
Is you have to know, like, are we talking about when you were 18 or when you were 65? Let's make sure we have all of the signposts here.
Mm-hmm.
And then what other aspects of your life are salient to this episode? Yeah. So, you know, I think it's self-evident that you have to sort of drill down a little bit when you're doing an interview. You can't just take the first iteration at face value. You have to probe.
Yeah, probe too until you get an answer that you like. If you still don't understand, or you need to keep drilling.
Yeah, I mean, not every concept, particularly when you're talking about art, you don't want anything too pat or too obvious. If a photographer or anybody has a kind of highly individualized understanding of an idea, well, that's the way you want it. You know, I think that you should always expect the reader to stretch a little bit. It would be like, you know, I read an article once that, you know, the average person has a working vocabulary of like 900 words. And obviously, a well-educated or well-read person might have a working vocabulary of 10,000 words. Who knows?
Shakespeare had 60,000, apparently.
Who knows? But the point is, if you wrote a book and you edited it for the person with the smallest vocabulary,
mm-hmm.
there would be absolutely no nuance. There would be no...
It's called a bestseller. That's what that's called.
There would be... You would have dumbed it down to such an extent that the subtlety of thought would have perished. So it's the same thing when an artist is explaining something.
Mm-hmm.
If it sounds exceedingly esoteric, you don't want to examine it until you get the dumbed down version. You want to preserve that peculiar, particular expression of thought. It's a matter of, you know, pulling this out and getting as much, seeing it in as many facets as you can, but still preserving every facet. And that way, you know, myself as the interviewer, but also the reader, can, you know, really get the best substance out of it.
Yeah, good readers want to be challenged.
I think so. I do think so. And, you know, you don't want to insult somebody's intelligence, you know, by putting in something obvious. These are limited edition books. They are, by definition, esoteric. You know, it comes with the social contract. If you're going to do a limited edition book, then it should be recondite in some aspect.
Yeah. Not too recondite, but just enough. Enough to stimulate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm not an advocate of academic writing that labors in the fields of obfuscation. I don't like that at all.
No.
That's why I say in the book that one of the big influences on my approach to the literary content of the book was the New Yorker magazine.
Yeah.
You know, back in the 70s, they had run a very extensive profile on Paul Strand by Calvin Tompkins. And I'd never read anything like this in the popular press ever. And I found it incredibly engaging. And this became the template. The New Yorker and the Paris Review became my two reference points in terms of a way to communicate about art. So, as I said, I'm not in favor of the academic propensity to obfuscate everything. But and by the same token, I think you can be lucid and conversational and still introduce some very refined thoughts expressed in a very esoteric way.
Yeah, you want to leave room for the reader. Number eight, you reference what you've already referenced, which is splicing together different answers from different takes, but maintaining the integrity of what was said. And then finally, you strive to be self-effacing. That's such a good one.
Yeah, I mean, every once in a while I'll do a book which I will structure into a monologue of the artist and just take out my questions completely. I did that with Siskin. I did that with Summer. I did that with, I think, one of the Dave Heath books. I use the question and answer when I think it's going to animate the book. I use the other technique when I think it's going to be conceptually more interesting. So, you know, there's no hard, fast rule about this.
Just in terms of not even necessarily editing, but in terms of interacting with these people, self-effacing people are just nicer to be around, you know.
Well, you know,
it may be an act, but you know, it's a really good point, I think.
At the end of the day, I don't lose sight of who the book's about. I may be the author, but I'm not the subject of the book. I keep that in mind. And it's my pleasure to do it that way.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, I don't have some kind of mission to change anybody's mind. You know, I want to celebrate the ideas that interest me and find a like-minded audience. So I don't really have to be the main event ever.
No, most of your books are about other people. I found it interesting, though, you did want to unite two different threads, I think, in your book. Of course, I can't remember what they are right now, but...
In this book?
In that book, you reference the fact that... that you do have something to say.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah, in my book, Anatomy, what I said was that I felt that the homage series, the series of monographs I'd done on photographers, incrementally were pursuing a kind of overview of the philosophy of photographic modernism. And I felt that when I had done all my books, if you took if you anthologized all my books, you'd have my philosophy doled out in each one of these volumes. But as I said, that's a pretty long-range plan. Mm-hmm. And by the early 90s, I was eager to get at least a provisional statement into print. So I wrote my book Anatomy to accompany a body of work I'd done and an exhibition that I was having.
Now, please don't take this the wrong way.
Right.
But I saw what I thought was an improvement in the writing from that point to this point. Maybe not improvement might be the wrong word. Maybe concision or a less abstract obfuscation. I'm not 100% sure. Anyway, I'm just interjecting there. Sorry, I interrupted.
I wonder, I haven't read that book in a while, but because I've only lived one life,
yeah,
I would guess that some of the experiences and anecdotes from that book 30 years ago probably reemerged in this book simply because they're my experiences, you know?
No, it wasn't so much for me. It wasn't so much that as I wanted. I couldn't grasp. There are things in there I couldn't quite grasp as well as I might wanted to have. Here, I just love the crispness and the... I'm not criticizing that book necessarily. I'm just saying that for myself, I preferred reading this one to that one.
Yeah, there are two different kinds of books.
Mm-hmm.
That one, your question was about getting my philosophy down on paper.
Right.
And that's what Anatomy was. I was trying to get my philosophy of photography, or at least my philosophy at that moment of my life. Because I'm not, as I said, I'm not dogmatic. I don't believe that it's like some kind of theological tract. Once it's written, it's cast in stone and you can't deviate from it. I believe that when you're in the arts, your philosophy of art is highly mutable and changes all the time based on your experiences and what you encounter, and also your concept of what you want to do next.
Yeah.
The next thing might not adhere 110% to something that preceded it, but you want to deviate. You don't want to stay on the same path all the time.
So we're not getting at what I can't remember here. They're going to have to read the book. I think, too, in this book, I particularly appreciated the way that the endings of each story snapped into place, particularly Ed Bertinsky chapter. That's just, again, I'm not going to give it away, but it's a lovely. And another thing, too, that bugged me throughout the book until the very end, and I realized... Oh, he was doing that intentionally. I really quite like that, too.
Okay. The actual ending of the book.
The very, very ending. The last line of the book. Yeah.
I'm glad you like that.
Anything else you want to say about anything?
I think the only thing I can really say is, since our last conversation, is that having my archive at the Fisher is one of the most gratifying things that's ever happened to me. They were enormously respectful. Everybody there is very professional. I admire the Fisher tremendously. And to have my archive, you know, cheek by jowl with the archive of, you know, people like Margaret Atwood, other people, Leonard Cohen, you know, it gives it, I guess, status and context. And of course, the exhibition was one of the highlights of my life. It was so beautifully installed. You talked to my co-curator, John Shoesmith, a number of years ago, and he really put a lot of work into that. And, you know, now that this book is a chronicle of that archive, it's really everything I ever wanted for this specific project, is to be able to bring in all the little bits and pieces from the archive that I preserved, all the, you know, marked up proof sheets and, you know, all the little flotsam and jetsam of a letterpress workshop. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay, so you got yourself down from the tree yourself. Thank you so much for talking with me about this project.
My pleasure.
The book is entitled Lumiere Press, Printer Savant, and Other Stories. And I've been talking with Michael Tarosian in his workshop in Toronto. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Oh, we clocked in at 3.5 hours.
Well, you got to get this down to 15 minutes, eh?